I'd like to welcome you all to this round table on chemical and biological weapons. The round table is organised here by the Centre for Global Governance at the LSE, and the Centre for Global Governance produces every year these splendid yearbooks. This is the yearbook for 2003, which was officially launched earlier in October. You can't actually get hard copies. This is one of the very rare hard copies that exist, but you will be able to get them soon. But at the moment, you can download all the chapters in the yearbook from the Centre for Global Governance website. As I say, the roundtable is organised by the Centre for Global Governance. My name is Nicholas Rose. I'm actually the director of another research centre here at the LSE, the BIOS Research Centre, which looks at the social aspects of bioscience, biomedicine and biotechnology. And this area of bioweapons and chemical weapons is clearly an issue where the interests of our two research centres overlap. No one who's come to this event this evening needs me to point out what a crucial geopolitical status the question of chemical and biological weapons has assumed over the last 5 or 10 years in particular. Whatever the reality of the nature, the existence, the location of chemical and biological weapons, the idea of chemical and biological weapons, the perceived threat of chemical and biological weapons, has had a massive effect both on geopolitical questions of security and on questions of security within any individual country. And those are some of the questions that are going to be raised tonight. Since we're a little bit late, without more ado, I'd like to start the debate off. We're going to have 4 contributions to the debate, each of about 15 minutes, and then we're going to have half an hour at the end for general comments and questions. If I can just introduce the speakers in the order in which they'll be presenting. At the end there is Daniel Feeks, who's a research fellow at SPRU, working on science and technology policy at the University of Sussex. Next to him is Sue Manley, who's the Executive Director of GeneWatch UK. Next to her is, Sue Mayer, excuse me, and I'm doing a very good job as my chair already, so you'll be pleased to hear that I don't have much more to say. Next to her is Ron Manley, who's formerly of the UK Chemical and Biological Defence Establishment, and was a member of the UNSCOM Destruction Advisory Panel. And next to me is Professor Matthew Messelson, who's the Thomas Dudley Cabot Professor of Natural Sciences at Harvard. As I say, each of our speakers is going to talk for about 15 minutes and then give us time for discussion at the end. So without more ado, I'll hand over to them.
Thank you. Can everyone hear me, yeah? Okay, tonight I would like to explain how governments and civil society have framed the issue of chemical and biological weapons. I'd like to relate this to the real-world failure of civil society to counter the weapons of mass destruction, or WMD, hype in the run-up to the invasion of Iraq. And I'd also like to explain why civil society played this largely reactive role, and finally outline how civil society might avoid repeating this failure in the future. I'd like to begin by outlining the 3 ways in which chemical and biological weapons have been framed since at least the late 19th century. While this is presented chronologically, there is significant overlap between all 3 frames. The first frame is what I call the taboo frame. The taboo against the use of chemical and biological weapons is cross-cultural and ancient. It can be traced back to Greek, Roman, Sanskrit and Islamic sources. Until the 19th century, chemical and biological agents were used mainly for covert acts such as poisoning, assassination and sabotage. The 19th century saw the industrialization of chemistry and initial thinking about the application of the new technology to warfare. The first codifications of the taboo came in the late 19th and 20th centuries, particularly with the Hague declarations of 1899 and 1907. But these were ignored with massive use of chemical weapons by all sides during World War I. After World War I, public hostility to chemical weapons contributed to further codification of the taboo with the Geneva Protocol of 1925. However, again, chemical weapons were widely used between the wars. During the Russian Civil War, by Britain in the Middle East and Afghanistan, by Spain in Morocco, by Italy in Libya, by the USSR in Sinkiang, by Italy in Abyssinia, and by Japan in China. Chemical and biological weapons were not used in World War II, but the discovery of nerve gases promised increasingly lethal chemical weapons, and developments in aerobiology ushered in potential for biological agents to be used as tactical or even strategic weapons. The taboo frame was supplanted after World War II by what I term the WMD, weapons of mass destruction frame. Despite recent assertions, the term WMD is not new. It was first coined in the 1940s with the United Nations attempts to devise a system for the regulation of armaments. This reflects the main feature of the WMD frame, namely the negotiation and implementation of multilateral treaties with progressively stronger verification systems. The 1950s and 60s were marked by extensive national CBW chemical and biological weapons programs, particularly in the US and the Soviet Union, but to a lesser degree also in Canada, the UK, France, and others. Chemical weapons have been used in at least three conflicts since World War II, in Vietnam, in Yemen, and also in the Iran-Iraq War. There's been no verified use of biological weapons since World War II. The use of tear gas in Vietnam by the US led to a huge public and international attention being paid to chemical and biological weapons, and also to the start of diplomatic moves to further codify the taboo, which led to the negotiation of the Biological Weapons Convention, which was the first multilateral treaty to outlaw a class of weapons of mass destruction, but which still lacks provisions for verifying compliance with it. Despite being a depository of the Bioweapons Convention, the Soviet Union continued and accelerated its biological weapons program under cover of its legitimate biotech industry. A number of factors, including Iraq's use of chemical weapons against Iran and the Kurds, contributed to pushing forward negotiations on a chemical weapons convention, which were eventually finalized in a window of opportunity created by the end of the Cold War. Unlike the biological convention, the chemical weapons convention has an unprecedented and elaborate verification system. In retrospect, the 1990s saw the zenith of the WMD frame for chemical and biological weapons, with the entry into force of the chemical convention, 7 years negotiation of a verification protocol to strengthen the biological convention, and practical experience of inspections in Iraq and also in Russia, the UK and the US. The WMD frame appears to have ended in 2001 with the collapse of the negotiations on a biological weapons protocol following its rejection by the US and also the US reaction to September the 11th. The third frame is what I term the chemical and biological terrorism frame, which overlaps to a degree with the weapons of mass destruction frame, since there has been increasing concern about terrorism and WMD since the 1995 attack on the Tokyo subway. Like the WMD frame, the terrorism frame is firmly embedded in the state security discourse, in which states monopolize the use of force and foreclose civil society's capacity to contest or question the weapons which secure states' existence. But the terrorism frame has become much more relevant since September the 11th and the anthrax attacks, even though the former didn't involve chemical or biological weapons, and the latter appear to be domestic in origin. Since September 11th, terrorism and chemical and biological weapons have been explicitly linked by the UK and US governments to form what one commentator has termed a nexus of proliferation and terrorism, located within President Bush's axis of evil. On the eve of the invasion of Iraq, Prime Minister Blair told the House of Commons that WMD and terrorism present a real and present danger to Britain and its national security. The US response to this has not been multilateral or diplomatic, but characterized by an emphasis on national measures, epitomized in the concept of homeland security, and by a new doctrine of preemption. As an example of the regressive globalization described in another yearbook chapter, the US has engaged when in its own interests, and mostly bilaterally or in selective coalitions, but disengaged and obstructed when its interests appear to be impinged upon, for example, with its rejection of the protocol to the Biological Weapons Convention. It is this chemical and biological terrorism frame which has been in the ascendancy since September the 11th, and which was particularly in evidence in the WMD hype of late 2002 and early 2003. This period was marked by unprecedented attention to weapons of mass destruction in the US and the UK, mainly in relation to Iraq, but also in connection with terrorism and WMD proliferation more generally. At least in the UK, there can be no doubt that Iraq's alleged possession of WMD was the main justification for the invasion. Introducing the famous dossier in September 2002, the Prime Minister said, "The threat is not imagined. The history of Saddam and WMD is not American or British propaganda. The history and the present threat are real." A report released today by the Cardiff School of Journalism states that the media generally believed government claims about Iraq's possession of WMD as well. The government placed particular importance on the imminence of the threat from Iraq. The Prime Minister's introduction to the dossier said, "I am in no doubt that the threat is serious and current. The government's objective was to play up the urgency of meeting the threat, but we now know from the Hutton inquiry that even the Prime Minister's Chief of Staff acknowledged that a threat wasn't imminent. And we also know from the inquiry that references in the dossier which downplayed the immediacy of the threat were removed. The infamous 45-minute claim was leapt upon by a media looking for sensationalist headlines. I don't suppose everyone can actually see these, but you have front page screaming headlines like Saddam can strike in 45 minutes, 45 minutes from attack, and Brits 45 minutes from doom, which kind of characterized the response in the media. One analyst has said that this is a damning indictment of the level of public understanding about these matters, that this claim was allowed to metamorphosize into a demonstration of imminent threat from Iraqi WMD. From the Hutton inquiry, we now know that 45-minute claim probably applied to artillery shells filled with mustard gas rather than missiles which could reach Cyprus, as the Sun claimed. An integral part of the run-up to the invasion were the numerous terrorist scares, the discovery of ricin in January 2003, tanks surrounding Heathrow Airport in February, and rumours of cyanide attacks on the London Underground. All of these contributed to a climate of fear and paranoia. We now know that many of the claims made before the invasion were false. As revealed in its recent interim report, the Iraq Survey Group, this is the group that's now looking at WMD or suspect WMD sites in Iraq, said that it has not found any WMD in Iraq. On chemical weapons, the leader of the group, David Kay, was surprisingly honest. He said multiple sources with varied access and reliability have told the ISG that Iraq did not have a large, ongoing, centrally controlled chemical weapons program after 1991. Information found to date, he carried on, suggests that Iraq's large-scale capability to develop, produce, and fill new chemical weapons munitions was reduced, if not entirely destroyed. Compare that with the Prime Minister in September 2002, who said, on chemical weapons, the dossier shows that Iraq continues to produce chemical agent for chemical weapons and has rebuilt previously destroyed production plants across Iraq. In the UK, the Hutton inquiry has shown that even back in 2002, intelligence officials had concerns about claims in the dossier, which they said over-egged certain assessments in relation particularly to the production of chemical weapons agents and weapons since 1998. Even more dramatically, in the US, a senior retired intelligence official has publicly accused the Bush administration of having what he called a faith-based intelligence attitude. He called it top-down use of intelligence and said that the attitude was, we know the answers, give us the intelligence to support those answers. The attention to WMD has continued after the removal of Saddam Hussein and is now part of the wider war on terrorism. On the eve of invasion, the Prime Minister told the House of Commons, I know there are several countries that are desperately trying to acquire chemical weapons, biological weapons, or in particular nuclear weapons capability. This activity is not diminishing, it is increasing. In the US, the focus has switched to Iran, North Korea, and Syria. Just last week, the neoconservative US Undersecretary for Arms Control and International Security, John Bolton, was here in London addressing the Bruges Group, and the title of his speech was The New World After Iraq, The Continuing Threat of Weapons of Mass Destruction. However, I would argue that the concept of WMD is a misleading and inaccurate one. The run-up to the Iraq invasion saw massive use of the term WMD by politicians, the media, and commentators. In fact, the American Dialect Society voted WMD the word of 2002. But there was little attempt to explain the term. Indeed, it was often described as recent, which I've already said it's not. However, many experts are uneasy with the term as it lumps together three very different categories of weapon. Many feel that the only true weapon of mass destruction is a nuclear weapon, as it causes both mass casualties and mass destruction, and is almost impossible to defend against. While some biological weapons could cause mass deaths, neither they nor chemical weapons cause mass destruction, and both can be protected against. Many experts believe that chemical weapons should not be classified as WMD at all. The classification of chemical and biological weapons as WMD makes it easier to justify military action as in Iraq. It was widely acknowledged before the invasion that Iraq didn't have nuclear weapons, but by calling chemical and biological weapons WMD, the spectre of nuclear weapons remained in the background. This simplification of the issue is attractive to the media and useful to the government, but problems with the definition were not loudly heard in the run-up to the invasion. The government and the media simplified a complex issue, and civil society was unable to counter this effectively and present an alternative view. despite the fact that many pre-invasion civil society concerns have subsequently been borne out. So why was this? Civil society activity, at least in the UK, was largely reactive. It would answer inquiries and questions from the press, rather than proactive. I would contend that the main reason for this was the nature and the usual activities of civil society actors involved in chemical and biological weapons. My chapter contains a detailed description of the nature and activities of civil society involved, but I'll only summarise some of those now. Some people even doubt that civil society is involved at all in chemical and biological weapons, but I'm using a definition which includes both academics and activists, insiders and outsiders, so I would disagree with that. The civil society actors involved in chemical and biological weapons provide a good example of what's known as an epistemic community. They demonstrate expertise and competence in chemical and biological weapons, and they have policy-relevant knowledge. But unlike, for example, nuclear disarmament or the environment, there is no larger network of activists or campaigners beyond the epistemic community. Civil society actors involved are largely academic, elite insiders based in Western universities or think tanks, who have been described as people who don't know whether they want to document or change the world. Other features, both positive and negative, include continuity. Many individuals in this field have been around for many, many years and have a good knowledge of the issues going back decades in some cases. An adversity to taking risks, reflecting the academic and official backgrounds of many participants. On the positive side, well connected to governments and to international organizations, but also fairly isolated from other sectors of civil society. In my chapter, I describe the sector as discreet in its activities and restrained in its policy proposals. Civil society actors have largely been untouched by developments in wider global civil society in the 1990s, but the recent emergence of a group in America and Germany called the Sunshine Project, which is staffed by former environment and biotech activists with a proactive and innovative agenda, and the establishment of something called the Bioweapons Prevention Project in Geneva, which is a global network and monitoring activity, could signal changes. The activities of civil society in chemical and biological weapons are reflective of the nature of the organizations and individuals involved and of the centrality of the state in WMD and the terrorism frames. Civil society is marginalized in a gender setting and denied access to most international negotiations and meetings regarding chemical and biological weapons. Civil society is more active with regard to the normative aspects of chemical and biological weapons, as the treaties provide standards which are useful in identifying backsliding by states. To some extent, civil society also acts as a guardian of the original intent of the treaties and of the taboo itself. And the scientific background of many individuals means there's an interest in the ethical dimension too. The main focus of civil society activity in this area is the provision of information and expertise. This reflects the academic background of many participants. The main target audiences are seen as policymakers and diplomats, other civil society actors, the media, and the general public. And that's in that order as well, with government officials seen as the primary audience. There's little evidence of public advocacy and mobilization work. As one associate explained, we have excellent subject matter experts but don't know how to do outreach. This is due mainly to the nature of the actors involved. Universities don't generally encourage advocacy work. The complexity of the subject, the general difficulty of engaging with the public on disarmament issues, and the fact that both the chemical and biological treaties, by their mere existence, give the impression that the problem has been dealt with. Civil society has had some success with lobbying, but again, it's an activity which doesn't come naturally to most of those involved. When it does take place, it's usually at a national level. Civil society in this area has no direct participation in the formulation of treaties, given the centrality of the state, but it does play a role in transmitting ideas indirectly through meetings such as those organized by the Pugwash conferences on science and world affairs. Civil society has exploited the minimal opportunities for monitoring that states allow, and this is perhaps increasing on both a national and international level, mainly through the work of the Sunshine Project and the Bioweapons Prevention Project that I mentioned earlier. The involvement of civil society in chemical and biological weapons is now in a phase of transformation, I argue in my chapter, with four primary driving forces: the apparent end of multilateral treaty making, a heightened public awareness of chemical and biological weapons, developments in other sectors of civil society, and the creation of an alternative frame for chemical and biological weapons. While some of these have occurred in the past, what is unique now is the combination of all four and the interplay between them. In my chapter, I suggest four strategies to further this transformation. Chemical and biological weapons need to be reframed away from the state-centric, abstract and technically complex focus on WMD and towards a more inclusive and resonant alternative. My chapter suggests that such an alternative could be based on emphasizing the threat that chemical and biological weapons pose to global security rather than national security, and a return to the taboo against chemical and biological weapons, and also on making explicit linkages to public health and biodiversity for more relevance to developing countries and civil society in the developing world, and also by introducing the concept of individual responsibility for violations of the taboo. The run-up to the invasion of Iraq demonstrated that civil society needs to be more proactive in explaining the technicalities to journalists so that the threats are more accurately presented to the general public. For example, the media has leapt on the idea of terrorists with chemical and biological weapons, but consistently failed to explain technical hurdles that terrorists would face. This isn't the problem of the journalists, it's often the problem of us as experts telling the journalist, or being in touch with the journalists to tell them the information that they need. Civil society also needs to make more use of opportunities like treaty anniversaries and other kinds of international meetings which can be used to raise public awareness. The run-up to the war in Iraq should have been seen as an opportunity to counter the hysteria surrounding terrorists with WMD and to flag problems with the definition of WMD. There's also a need to break out of the isolation and to share isolation of civil society working in chemical and biological weapons with the wider global civil society in order to share expertise, but also to learn lessons from others. There's a need to link with other disarmament civil society actors, those involved in nuclear disarmament, landmines, small arms and so on, but also to make links with the anti-war movement, with environment groups, biodiversity groups, public health groups and the humanitarian sector. By taking this approach, civil society could avoid repeating its failure in the run-up to the invasion of Iraq. Thanks.
Okay, we're going to move straight on, and I'll introduce Sue Meyer from GWatch.
Thanks very much. I want to, this evening, just carry on to a certain extent from Daniel's presentation, but before finishing off by looking at how perhaps we might do better at involving wider civil society and particularly publics in this debate around chemical and biological weapons, I want to first of all outline why GeneWatch, for example, has been interested in the subject of biological weapons in a very peripheral way. And I want to also consider how this increasing focus on bioterrorism that we have at the moment and is actually restricting critical analysis and our overview, not just around biological weapons, but all about developments in genetic technologies more widely and making it difficult to access information and to critique them. So, first of all, why is GeneWatch concerned about biological weapons? And of course, it comes down to the potential of the technology which has been to transform the usefulness, inverted commas, of biological weapons. Biological weapons at the moment, we know, in fact, there are many ways of killing people with biological agents at the moment. Anthrax isn't genetically modified, but it's a very effective agent to kill people with. But there are certain restrictions on the use of different organisms. They may not last very long in the environment, they may affect people very slowly, they may be difficult to keep and put in weapons to actually deliver. And genetic modification, by introducing genes, by changing the genetic makeup, may go some way to addressing some of those problems of people who want to make biological weapons. So for example, you could change the virulence, enable organisms to infect people and cause more rapid disease, to produce different toxins so that they would kill people more quickly. you may be able to make them more robust, make them more able to survive in the environment. One good thing about anthrax, if you're interested, if you think biological weapons are a good thing, is that it's quite a robust organism. So there are characteristics in that organism that you could transfer perhaps to others through genetic modification to make them more robust in the environment. Or you could make it difficult to treat a disease, so that if an organism was used in warfare, the people that were infected with it would find it more difficult to deal with it. So you may introduce genes which would give antibiotic resistance, for example, or may make it resistant to vaccines, so conventional vaccines wouldn't work. Or you may just simply be able to improve transmission or increase the spectrum of organisms which a weapon may infect. And of course, we aren't just talking, it's worth remembering here, that we're not just talking about biological weapons that may affect people. There have, of course, equally been interest in producing biological weapons which could affect animals or plants, because those could be extremely attractive economically as ways of disabling economies and obviously making it difficult to feed people. And of course, with genetic modification, and we've seen this already, when you're investigating and using these techniques, it's possible to not necessarily deliberately create organisms which could be useful in biological warfare, but also they can be inadvertently created. So we had a couple of years ago in Australia with mousepox virus was genetically modified in a way which made it resistant to vaccination, that the ways that normally mice could have been protected. And this raised the spectrum that you could use this in other disease-causing organisms to increase their pathogenicity. So that's one area that concerns us. And more controversially, and perhaps in much more uncertainly, it may, of course, by using the knowledge that we gather from the Human Genome Project, genomics more generally, may allow us to be better able to target biological weapons at different ethnic groups. The extent to which we will be able to do that, whether there will be markers that will differentiate between groups, is intensely controversial. But there are indications, and the Sunshine Project, which has been mentioned already, is publishing work at the moment which suggests that that will be possible to do. And of course, when we're talking about biological weapons, people won't necessarily be worried if a few extra people are inadvertently affected by a very blunt instrument. So these things would never be perfect, but it may be possible to narrow down the groupings which could be affected. And we're also, as well as being concerned about how genetic modification could be used by people to increase potency of biological weapons, we're equally concerned about the increases in research in biodefense. Because although biodefense research sounds logical, and in the United States at the moment, on the back of bioterrorism threats, supposed bioterrorism threat, there is vast investment going on into biodefense research. We have to think, and I don't think people think carefully enough, about the kind of knowledge that we are developing through that research, because when you do biodefense research, you shape the knowledge. You gather knowledge which will also be equally likely to be relevant to developing and using and weaponizing biological weapons. Because if you examine pathogenicity or interested in creating vaccines or testing vaccines, you often are designing and producing pathogens, for example. You may be introducing antibiotic resistance genes to consider ways of avoiding that. So when you gather this knowledge, when you have this vast investment in biodefense research, we could well be generating some very dangerous knowledge which will be directly applicable, rather than the more serendipitous knowledge which may emerge naturally from medical research. And so the whole enterprise, I think, is unsettling. And when we look across some of the things that are happening and being undertaken in research, not just inside biodefense programs, but more widely, there is this real sense of anxiety, and particularly the atmosphere of secrecy. And it's that it is starting to engender. And if we see what some researchers in the United States have published just very recently, their research recreating the 1918 flu virus, very bizarre piece of research to want to do, and that has come into an atmosphere of heightened tension around bioterrorism and how that knowledge will be received and used and how it will contribute to the process is quite an interesting question. It's very interesting also the scientists in the United Kingdom wanted to do that research in the mid-1990s, and I think we can thank the Health and Safety Executive for not being able to block the research on grounds that it wasn't useful or was very dubious, but simply because they crawled over the project so much and required such security that in fact, well, I don't know if we can be thankful, but that they've moved to the United States because it was seen as an easier and more receptive situation to do it. But there are that will raise real questions about how do we restrict research in this area with our current regulations. Very difficult to do in genetic modification in laboratories on grounds of necessity, need, where it's taking us. So those are the areas, some of the areas that make us be alert to this subject and worry about it. And why things are becoming more of a problem, I think, has been this creation that there is a severe and important threat from bioterrorism. It's something which we are deeply skeptical about in terms of its substance and its actuality. And the link with weapons of mass destruction that we've already heard about. And that is having some extremely important social consequences for us, because it is diverting time and resources to counter what is probably an exaggerated threat. Because terrorists most commonly use things like explosives and guns and weapons which are reliable and easy to use. And examples and analysis around genuinely about bioterrorism in the hands of it is very largely lacking. And I think it is building and is building a form of social control at the moment through this bioterrorism. It is getting people in the United States in particular to accept huge budgets being invested, not just in the public sector, but in the private sector. And in the UK even, we are buying into it. We're bringing in restrictions in terms of secrecy around GMOs and what we can have access to information. In 2002, the United Kingdom brought in restrictions on its public register of what organisms. Normally you could find out what experiments being done with higher security organisms in the UK. But as a result, after the light of events and subsequently from September the 11th, as they explained it, restrictions were brought in to take off a whole raft of organisms from the public register. And when that was reviewed, its impact, there'd been at least 50 experiments removed from the public register at 25 centres across this country. So we don't know, as civil society, where those experiments take. They won't have likely to have anything to do with biodefence at all, but we still don't know, because there are important reasons for people to scrutinise these, to question whether they're good enough, whether security is good enough, whether local communities feel that biosecurity is adequate, whether these are proper experiments that are should be going ahead. And the justification for that is that is to make information which is potentially useful to a terrorist more difficult to obtain. Well, they are very spurious justifications, I would suggest, that it takes very little expertise to find out, in fact, where those kinds of experiments actually are taking place and who's involved if you have a mind to. But it is restricting civil society scrutiny, not just in biological weapons terms, but more, as importantly, just in where some of the technology of genetic modification is taking to. And also we've seen moves, because of this apparent threat of bioterrorism, moves to restrict publication of certain scientific data by journals. Journals are trying to restrict that by bringing in self-policing rules. But there is a clear restriction on knowledge and data that we may be able to access. And that leads us really to the question which Daniel has highlighted, is why is there not more public engagement in this subject? Why is there so few civil society activist organisations in particular engaged in the area. And I agree very much that the highly restricted framing that there's been, that's very technical, which excludes, I don't think deliberately, but the very well-established networks that exist, make it very difficult for people to enter and challenge and help reframe that. I think it's extremely important that they have existed, those groups that are the academic networks. They've been extremely important and formed an important social function in monitoring what's going on. But I think we do need to prize open that. But I do know, because I know GeneWatch has felt it, we feel pretty powerless in terms of how to engage in this, how to get a foothold in this, this very secretive, very highly technical area of debate. And on top of that, this fear of bioterrorism, which is being used to control people, restrict their feeling of being able to enter into a debate, creating real tensions. And yet it's only, I think, through openness and inquiry that we will build security in this area, because secrecy builds tensions. It doesn't build openness about intention. And I think that learning from our experiences around GM issues more widely in this area, that because it's very difficult for a lot of organisations to suddenly get involved in biological and chemical weapons. They see them as important, but they're not primary to their objectives. And so it's very difficult to convince organisations to devote time and resources from agendas which they're already committed to doing. And so it is going to need, I think, the formation of a network which will have at its core a well-informed activist group who will be able to draw in other actors, other activist groups at particular times, at particular moments, to then bring in their publics with them and to supply them with the political analysis and the technical analysis and to give some force to that. I don't think that the network which has been set up already will be able to do that, because it's evolved from partly an academic network. I think it's going to have to come much more from activist groups. I don't know who they're going to be. But I should also say that groups like the Sunshine Project, which has been extremely important, incredibly impressive for a very, very tiny organisation, is barely struggling to fund itself. It has a scenario where it can hardly keep going at the moment, and it's very difficult to get funding. So there is another real question for people and for funders, I think, that we have to press, that those kind of groups have an important role, and unless they are given the resources, we won't change the dynamics of what's happening at the moment. Thank you.
I think we're beginning to see that the political deployment of the threat of bioweapons is at least as significant as bioweapons themselves. I'm going to hand over now to Ron Manley, who's ahead of the technology.
The graphic's going to work. Yeah. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'd like to take a slightly different tack, but also to expand a bit on what Daniel said and really look at one specific area. And really what I'd like to do is to give you a very quick overview of the problems that the United Nations had in dealing with Iraq's chemical and biological weapons. As most of you know, in 1991, at the end of the Gulf War, the Security Council passed what's known as the ceasefire resolution, which was Security Council Resolution 687. That set up a special commission. Now, it was a great idea. This special commission, 21 commissioners from 21 UN member states, supported by the UN Secretary General, led by Ambassador Rolf Verkaers, were given 44 days, or roughly 6 to 8 weeks, to solve the problem in Iraq. Now, as most of you know, it took a little bit longer than that. It had a very small headquarters staff, just a few UN people transferred over, plus a few people imported. An important point is, the inspectors it had did not belong to UNSCOM, they belonged to the member states that loaned them to UNSCOM. And so people were loaned to UNSCOM, and really UNSCOM had very little control over who those inspectors were and where they came from, and that did cause problems later on. When these commissioners met in New York and realized what they'd got themselves into, they basically decided that there were really three phases to the program. First of all, Iraq was required to make a declaration, which it did, And so the first part was to actually verify whether this declaration was correct, and that was done by carrying out inspections of not only just the declared sites but also undeclared sites in Iraq. Also, they found from the declaration that Iraq in fact did have a very large chemical weapons stockpile, and that was a problem because not only was it very large, but for many reasons it was in very poor condition, and some of it was in a really bad state. Once the weapons had been disposed of, the next problem of course was ongoing verification, because given the regime and its attitude towards chemical and biological weapons, it was considered that it was absolutely essential to have some form of verification regime to monitor that the Iraqi regime did not go back into producing chemical and biological weapons. Why was it difficult? Well, it was a unique verification exercise for a number of factors. First of all, unlike in the Second Gulf War in 1991, the coalition forces were a little bit less selective about how they damaged the infrastructure. And in fact, when we arrived in Iraq in the middle of 1991, there was severe damage to the infrastructure in Iraq. I mean, frankly, if it didn't move, it had been bombed. Not only that, but all of the facilities where the chemical munitions were stored, and to go back to Daniel's 45-minute point, now in 1991, these chemical munitions were ready. They were stored alongside the runways of their fighter bases and bomber bases. They were in their forward deployed areas, ready for their troops, and they were also stored at other locations across the country. So there were weapons all over the place, but of course, unfortunately, most of these sites had also been bombed as well. There were sanctions. The country was under sanctions, so therefore it was almost impossible to move stuff in and out, supplies that you might leave. And frankly, this is a surrender or a ceasefire resolution. The level of cooperation was not what one would quite like. I mean, this is not a state that was complying voluntarily, this is a state that was being forced to comply and assist. If you look, this is a list of Iraq's chemical agents that were available in 1991, and the dates are done, give you a rough idea of when they were actually produced. You'll see I have a question mark against, which should be against BX. That's because despite all of the hype by various governments and the various media, one is still not sure today whether there was a serious VX threat in Iraq. There's no doubt that the Iraqis tried to produce VX, but VX, let me assure you, is one of the most difficult of all nerve agents to produce. It's maybe the best, but it's the most complicated chemically to produce. And there is still great doubt amongst those people who know whether the Iraqis ever cracked that problem. And even if they did, to what extent. But that's just impossible. So they had quite a range of material. They had a number of facilities in Iraq that were developed. Now, Muthana was, and I'll show a bit more about that in a moment, was their main CW production facility. They also had a secondary facility at Mohammadiyah, and that's also where they did their testing and trials of chemical weapons. And a small research at Rashad. Fallujah has now become quite a famous place. If you'd asked anybody 5 months ago where Fallujah was, they wouldn't have known. But now everybody knows where Fallujah is, I guess, and what's new. But interestingly, in Fallujah, or around Fallujah, there were three separate sites, Fallujah 1, 2, and 3. Now, what's interesting about these were civilian sites. These were what we call dual-purpose sites. They were sites that, for example, at Fallujah 1, they were producing chlorine for water treatment. But they were also producing thionyl chloride and phosphorus trichloride, which are precursors for making chemical weapons, and for which they had no other use in Iraq. I mean, there is other uses for them, but the Iraqis had no other uses for them. So you have the problem there of facilities that were basically dual use, could be used for either. Muthana State Establishment, this was their main CW production area. To give you an idea, that square is 5 kilometers on a side, give you an idea of the scale. It is a very, very big facility. And all of those blocks, dots you can see are basically production plants, and I show one there, and the reason I show that is because it's still able to be photographed in 1991. Most of the others have been destroyed. There was a huge bunker area up in one corner, and this facility right down the bottom was the filling plant. Now, you can see what I mean about damaged infrastructure. I don't know how clear it is, but that filling plant was hit by 8 cruise missiles on January the 15th, the first day of the opening of the war. It was a great shame because there were no Iraqis there. They were very wise. They'd all gone home because they knew what was coming. The problem for us was, at the point of time, they'd actually been filling nerve agent rockets with nerve agent. And at that point of time, when it was hit by the cruise missiles, there were a large number of partially filled rockets, empty rockets, bulked nerve agent. And you can imagine what happened when that lot got hit. So we had a big contamination problem at Muthana. but that was their main site, to give you an idea of the scale of operation. And why is that important? Because I thought something Daniel said earlier on about producing chemical weapons. Let me assure you, you could make a small amount of chemical weapon in a laboratory if you want to carry out a terrorist attack. That's possible. You're talking about military capability. You're talking about a facility like this. In order to make chemical weapons on scale, you need serious infrastructure, despite what everybody keeps saying. This stuff was scattered all over Iraq. Eventually, we decided that we only had one option, and that was to ship it all back to Mathana and destroy it there. And so the UN set up a project where the UN supervised it, and frankly, the operations were done by the Iraqis under UN supervision. And we brought all of the stuff back to Mathana. And here you see the catalogue of material that was recovered. That's not their entire stockpile. First of all, that's what they declared and we found. Secondly, it's what wasn't destroyed in the bombing, and of course, or hadn't been used by the Iraqis in previous in the Iraq-Iran war. So we ended up with rather a large amount of material that we had to actually try and destroy. There were lots of problems with that. As I said, the infrastructure is very seriously damaged. If you wanted to do the problem properly, it would have taken many years. We didn't have many years. We had to do it as quickly as we could and as safely as we could. So basically, we took two approaches. The easiest way to destroy a chemical weapons or to build a chemical weapons destruction facility is to convert the chemical weapons production facility. Because if it was designed to produce chemical weapons, first of all, it has all the necessary infrastructure. Secondly, you have the trained personnel. The personnel at Mathana had known how to make chemical weapons, so they knew how to handle these materials. We were very lucky in this particular facility, which was a sarin production plant, had been hit by a 2,000-pound bomb, but the bomb didn't go off. So it was buried somewhere underneath the plant, but it hadn't gone off. So we had a basic structure. And in fact, over about 6 months, we actually converted that facility to a destruction facility. And all of the nerve agent that was on that previous slide was chemically broken down into non-toxic products, which were then sealed in concrete to stop them leaching. I mean, they were non-toxic for humans, but there's a potential of them leaching into the environment, and to avoid that, they were all sealed in concrete. But when it came to the mustard gas is very difficult to break down chemically. It can be done, and in fact is being done now, but it's still not easy, particularly when the mustard gas is not necessarily in good condition. The easiest, and the way it's done mostly around the world, is by incineration. But Iraq had no such thing as a hazardous incinerator for dealing with that sort of material. And so we built one with the Iraqis between us. We designed and built one. The little inset of this is inside the furnace. There's a group of UN people, including myself, I think, actually inside the furnace. That's just to give you an idea of the scale of that facility. It's not small. That furnace was run at 1,200 degrees centigrade, and at that temperature mustard would last about 10 seconds at the most. In fact, it spent about 2 minutes in there. The novel part on it was a gas cleanup plant. Iraq had never had a gas cleanup plant as well, but because the UN took the philosophy that it would use environmental standards that were acceptable anywhere around the world and not just in Iraq, we actually built the gas cleanup plant, and so all the exhaust gases from the facility were built. To cut a long story short, because we don't have a lot of time, it took us 2.5 years. That was with 100 UN personnel rotating through there from 25 countries, plus the Iraqi staff from the facility. But by the end of 1994, beginning of 1995, I was able to go back and hand back the whole site to Iraq, cleaned up without any chemical weapons and all the contamination removed, and all the buildings, frankly, that could be used to make for chemical weapons destroyed, including the destruction facilities, which were destroyed when we finished. Just briefly to look at AEW weapons in Iraq. The difference here was that in 1991, Iraq made no declaration of a BW program. It simply said it didn't have one. However, after the first inspection in August, it was very clear that they'd at least had a research program. And so after being challenged by the BW inspectors, Iraq admitted that it did have BW research. And really, after that, despite a lot of inspections, things didn't change. And then in July 1995, and this is largely due to the defection of Hussein Kamal, his brother-in-law, who basically went over into Jordan, the Iraqis suddenly decided, well, yes, actually they had produced large-scale production of biological agents. More importantly, they also admitted that they'd weaponized those agents and had actually put them into weapons. In fairness, they claimed that all that lot had been destroyed in 1991, that they'd actually destroyed all the biological weapons and all the unweaponized material before the UNSCOM inspectors turned up. That's where some of the problems come, and I'll talk a bit more about that in a moment. It then went on over the years to make three more declarations, and in 1997, a UN panel of experts decided that we still didn't know the extent of Iraq's BW program, and that's where some of the problems stem from. In terms of agents, they had weaponized anthrax, botulinum toxin. Interestingly enough, they'd worked on ricin, but actually decided that it was a waste of time. They'd made a very small amount of ricin, did some trials, weapons trials, and decided it actually wasn't a very practical agent. They worked on gas gangrene. Nobody ever knows why, because to be honest, nobody in the world has ever used Clostridium perfringens as a biological weapon, or even intended to use it as a biological weapon. But there you go. I put question marks against smallpox, again, because despite what several governments said, and despite what the media said, the United Nations was never able to find a single shred of evidence that Iraq had either had access to smallpox or that it had done any research on smallpox at all. And as far as I know, that stays the same today. We've never been able to find any link to smallpox in Iraq. BW-related facilities, again, this illustrates the difference between chemical and biological. In biological, you do have a problem because it's much easier to do biological weapons production in civilian facilities. And while, again, they did BW research at Marthana, at the same chemical site, and they also built a purpose-built biological weapons production facility at Al-Hakam, and they did their trials at Mohammediyat, so they did their chemical trials at the same place they did the biological weapons. But they also used civilian facilities. Again, Fallujah 3, where they made the ricin. Al-Taj was a single-cell protein plant, which they converted to produce botulinum toxin. Dora was a vaccine unit, a foot-and-mouth vaccine unit, which they converted, in fact, to produce both anthrax and toxin. Al-Safa was an agricultural food and water research facility, and was actually used to do research on alpha toxin. So you have this problem about, you know, when is it and when is it not. Just to give you some figures, I'll be frank with you, we do not know how good these figures are. They're the best figures anybody's came up with, but it gives you an idea of the sort of scale of material they produced. And in fact, the weapons they choose, you can see they did weaponize at the end. On my screen here, the weaponize is flashed over on top of the degree, but it should be over the far column. And that represents that 10,000 litres, 6,500 litres, represents probably somewhere in the order of 400 or 500 weapons, mostly bombs, missile warheads, which is what they use. In fact, they're all either missile warheads, Al-Hussein missile warhead filled, or they were filled into aerial bombs. They were never filled into rockets or to shells. Areas of uncertainty. The problem was that when UNSCOM really was coming to the end of its operations in 1998, we still had some problems. While I would say that UNSCOM felt it had a very good understanding of Iraq's chemical weapons program, it still could not necessarily make the BW agent production figures add up. The numbers filled and destroyed, because they'd all been destroyed before we actually arrived on the scene in 1991, although they dug out the destruction sites and sort of counted how many fragments they could find and actually did analysis, it was almost impossible to be sure how many munitions had been destroyed. So you have this problem of arithmetic. The Iraqis started developing on a biological weapons drop tank project. This is flown underneath an aircraft and dropped from an aircraft. Again, we know trials were done, but nobody was ever sure how far the program had gone. Equally, they were looking at using an aerosol spray generator underneath an aircraft. And again, the full extent of their research program was unknown. So that you can see where the problems came to the UN and why it came into problems. UNSCOM now moving. Clearly, as time went by, the United Nations Special Commission was losing the support of most of the countries on the Security Council. There's no doubt about it. There are many reasons for this. Several countries on the Security Council felt that trying to dot every T and every I was just not going to work. It wasn't going to be practical ever to come up with a scene and say, this is definitely finished. Other countries felt that some members of UNSCOM were in there gathering intelligence information, and frankly, they were. while the vast majority of UNSCOM personnel genuinely went there to do the job they were supposed to do, there were always a few who came from certain agencies and frankly were there to run other agendas. And it clearly wasn't working. So in the end, it was in fact decided to abolish UNSCOM and to establish a new. The difference between UNMOVIC was the decision was taken in UNMOVIC that the inspectors would work for the United Nations and not for their countries. They would be paid for by the UN, although they would come for countries, they would be paid by the UN, and they would do what the Chemical Weapons Convention did, whereas in the Chemical Weapons Convention, all of the inspectors worked for the CWC. More importantly, they were all trained by the Chemical Weapons Convention Secretariat. And so they decided this time that not only would they take inspectors in for themselves, but they would give them a training program before they sent them into the country. The rest of it's history. Iraq finally allowed inspectors in November 2002, and they were thrown out in 2003, just before the bombing started. Just to summarise all this, I think the real problem here is that UNSCOM had, and it was a problem for everybody, is an accounting problem. And I point it's an accounting problem. It doesn't say that something actually is fair. It means that you can't balance the books. It's true. It was impossible to be 100% sure that every chemical and biological weapon had been accounted for. It didn't mean to say, despite what the media said, that they existed. It meant that it couldn't be accounted for. It was just not possible to balance the sum. You have a situation where you couldn't be sure what the country imported, you couldn't be sure what it made, you couldn't be sure how much it had used in the Iraq-Iran war. It had used large amounts in the Iraq-Iran war. You couldn't be sure how much had been destroyed in the bombing. You couldn't be sure how much they voluntarily destroyed. The only figure we knew is how much we, the United Nations, had destroyed. And the same applies to empty munition cases, production equipment. You go to a plant that's making a medical drug. Much of the equipment is suitable for use for making VW or chemical weapons. How do you decide which it belongs to? We knew that Iraq actually had used such facilities to do work, but how do you know which is genuine and which is not? So there were many gaps, and that's where really the things came to a head, and people drew many conclusions from that. And I would just point out to you one thing that Hans Blix said, and he said this several times, but this is an extract from his speech to the Security Council basically in February 2003 when he was saying, I need more time. And the key point here is, as he pointed out then, it's an accounting problem. It doesn't mean that these things exist. What it means is we can't say whether they do or they don't exist. And people forgot that. They didn't choose to remember that part of his program. And since then, Blix has said on a number of occasions since the war, you know, that he was relatively convinced that they didn't exist. But of course, it's like everything else. You can never, ever close it off entirely. So, you know, what did the UN achieve? Well, personally, I think the UN accounted for 95% of Iraq's chemical weapons. We could never be sure that we'd accounted for everything, but we were pretty sure we'd got 95% of it. We knew we'd destroyed their CW and BW production facilities. All the facilities that they had that we were known to be used for CW and BW were destroyed, either during the bombing or by the United Nations subsequently. We'd learned an awful amount about their BW program. And we learned an awful lot about the capabilities of a country. Because again, when you're deciding whether a country can make chemical and biological weapons, you need to know something about its infrastructure. It's no good accusing a country that has no chemical infrastructure of making chemical weapons. How is it doing it? Where is it getting the raw materials? How is it carrying out the chemistry? If it doesn't have a sophisticated biotechnology capability, it's not making BW weapons. A classic case is the mobile units, the famous mobile units, which now everybody knows, for example, had canvas sides. I'm sorry, the Iraqis were not stupid. If you're going to make anthrax, you do not make it in something that doesn't have full containment. Yes, you can make anthrax in a mobile facility, but that mobile facility has to be capable of containing what's inside it, because if it doesn't, you have it everywhere. So again, it's about, we learnt an awful lot. Anyway, it's my time, so I will just say thank you.
The subject of biological weapons is very difficult to talk about because of the lack of data. Biological warfare has not occurred. occurred, at least not occurred in places from which we could get much information. There's a great deal of misinformation in the field, a lot of misunderstanding, a lot of disinformation. The data that we do have, it's hard to know whether it's relevant. One can write lists of microorganisms and some things about their properties, but what does that mean? And then finally, a good deal of the information has been seen both in the intelligence communities and in the public through political lenses. So it's a very difficult subject, at least for a scientist, to talk about. Almost embarrassing. So I'm not going to try to talk about the subject in a methodical way, but rather from a personal point of view. I am a biologist. I work in the field of molecular genetics. And what I'm going to talk about is the problem of disabling chemical and biological weapons. And bear in mind, I don't have a lot of data. We have three 20th century treaties that deal with chemical or biological weapons: the Geneva Protocol of 1925, and then, of course, the Biological Weapons Convention of 1972, and the Chemical Weapons Convention of 1993. The Geneva Protocol prohibited use in war, poisons, asphyxiating, etc., was prohibited. It did not prohibit the development, stockpiling, training, doctrine, and all that. And several major nations developed large establishments, both chemical and biological. So that's a very different treaty from the next two, because the Biological Weapons Convention and the Chemical Weapons Convention prohibit the development, production, transfer, acquisition, etc., of chemical and biological weapons, so that the existence of a facility making them or of a stockpile of them is prohibited under these two treaties. How do these two treaties define what it is that's prohibited? The negotiators face two problems. One is that technology is constantly producing new things, and so the approach of listing specifically chemicals or specifically biological agents that should be prohibited would not work, because you would have to keep on adding to the list and have a continuous disaster. Of World War I, phosgene is at the heart of part of the plastics industry. So these two problems were got around by what is called the general purpose criterion. The idea is a simple one. For example, in the case of biological weapons, microbial and other biological weapons and toxins are prohibited, except in types and kinds that are justifiable for prophylactic or other peaceful purposes. So if you see a small vial, for example, let's say of anthrax, that could be used for scientific purposes. If you see, on the other hand, munitions loaded with dry anthrax spores, that's obviously prohibited. So it's not a standard that lends itself to absolutely crystal clear distinctions, nor do the others, even if they even tried to write them down on paper, how many molecules of the molecule was prohibited would be actually prohibited. That wouldn't have worked either. But the general purpose criterion gets at something that's very important: the element of intent. It is, after all, intent that lies at the heart of any treaty violation. If you inadvertently make something, that's not a threat. It's if you intended to do something hostile with it, that's the threat. So the general purpose criterion, this idea of prohibiting things unless they can be justified in types and in quantities that are consistent with peaceful purposes. The Chemical Weapons Convention does this even more explicitly by listing the purposes that are not prohibited. This is one that should be. So, is this on, by the way? Good.
Trying to do something.
Can you hear back there?
Only just.
Is this better back there?
Oh, good. So the Chemical Weapons Convention actually lists the purposes that are not prohibited: industrial, medical research, One of them is law enforcement and domestic riot control. And I'll come to the importance of that. It's very striking that the Chemical and Biological Weapons Conventions came along when they did. In the case of the Biological Weapons Convention, it was on the very eve of the explosion in molecular biology. It might have been, even though perhaps irrational, I think they're tuning up their volume as we tune up ours, that just the excitement in the field of molecular biology, even if there were no substance to the potential uses for weapons, just the feeling there might be something out there might have prevented that treaty from coming into existence. But it did. And in the case of the chemical treaty, we'll come back in a moment to something I think that's important that helped bring that into existence. Now, a huge subject is how do we maintain and nurture these really excellent agreements? On paper, they're excellent. How do we maintain and nurture them? And there are, of course, numerous possibilities, and that's a long discussion. I'm not going to have time or I'm not going to talk about that. Instead, I'm going to try to foresee how these standards might unravel, how they might unravel. And I'm going to take the approach of a chemist. When a chemist has some reactants and is thinking of whether they might react and make some products, he needs to know what is the energy barrier in going from the reactants to the products. If it's a high energy barrier, the reaction won't go. You can have hydrogen and oxygen in a cylinder, and if you don't light a match to it, they won't combine to make water. On the other hand, there's some reactions that go forward easily. So what sorts of things might unravel the Chemical and Biological Weapons Conventions? What is the activation energy? Well, you could say, what if a country launches a massive lethal biological attack in a war? I think that's very unlikely. Any country that contemplates doing that would know that there would be a terrible retribution. Seems to me that would have a very high activation energy. What would have a low activation energy? Well, that's, I think, where this problem of riot control and law enforcement come in. Because there is great interest now. The world has changed a bit. We think more about what you call the peacekeeping operations or occupation activities, the importance of reducing civilian and other casualties, the fact that our citizens watch military actions over television, and if there's a lot of blood or a lot of death, it creates political opposition to what governments might want to do. Besides that, the technical field is just alive with new ideas on how to make weapons that might not always kill, that might seldom kill. And let me digress for just a moment about that. There's some things that have been known for quite a while. There are receptors in the brain, for example. We know how to identify how many there are. There's several hundred at least. What most of them do, we have no idea. But some of them that are familiar, the opioid receptors, which are the targets for what is thought to be what was used in the case of the rescue of the hostages in the Moscow theater. The problem with it so far is that although it does cause flaccid paralysis and loss of memory, it also stops respiration if you get too much. But there's a lot of interest in finding out how to avoid the respiratory hazard of these fentanyl-like compounds and other opioids. There's a whole new thing that's come into view just to give you a feeling for how rapidly this feeling changes. It's a group of molecules called cadherins. These are molecules that tell what cell should join onto what other cell. And there are hundreds of genes, hundreds of different cadherins, and these are particularly localized at synapses in the brain. They're involved in the initial development of the brain, in telling axons where to attach, in developing synaptic specificities. And throughout life, they're involved in the
plasticizing of synapses. That means learning or changing the way our brains work. These molecules would seem also to be able to be varied in the same way that immunoglobulins are varied by either what's called differential splicing or actual rearrangement of the DNA level is not quite clear yet, but it seems that even the number of genes that specify these molecules can be greatly exceeded, the number can be greatly exceeded by subsequent modifications, either in the genes, as our immune systems do, or in differential splicing of the messenger RNA. All these words only mean that it looks as though we're beginning to understand a large part, just beginning, but a large part of how the brain is wired and how the changes in the wiring might be accomplished. Now, there's something else that's new, not quite as new as these adherents, but it's RNAi. It's a way of stopping the action of given genes. These cadherins need to be made continually be replenished in very specific ways that are just beginning to be understood. And one could, in principle at least, interfere with that by means of, and I won't have time to tell you what it means, but something called RNAi, which could in principle maybe be aerosolized and used. Now, I'm not really arguing that you could get good weapons this way by any of these technologies. Most of these have been flops so far. The people who've tried to develop useful non-lethal weapons generally haven't come up with much. We still have a regular CS, tear gas, and so on. But it creates a lot of excitement and a lot of interest, a lot of momentum, and a lot of money. And that can tincture political decisions. In the United States, we have the Council on Foreign Relations, which is a very serious, responsible group of people interested in foreign policy. And they have now a working group on non-lethal weapons. Its report ought to be out about now. It's the second report. The first one came out in July of 1999. If I had my eyeglasses, I could read. One of its recommendations, this is July 1999, in the report of this panel, on occasion, United States security might be improved by a modification to the Chemical Weapons Convention or the Biological Weapons Convention. In that case, the Department of Defense should propose such a step to the National Security Council and the interagency mechanism involved to ensure the evaluation of the overall costs and benefits. Well, even to talk about modifying the Chemical and Biological Weapons Conventions to allow the use of some chemical or biological weapons that are thought to be less than lethal appeals to some people, but it seems to me that that's the low activation energy way in which these two conventions could become unraveled. This country, the United Kingdom, has generally opposed the introduction of riot control agents, for example, into military operations. Back in June 1994, when we were facing the operations in Kosovo, a very high-level official of your country sent a message to a high-level official of my country saying very politely that this would be a very bad idea to use riot control agents in so-called military modes to save lives. But this is a real promise. There's growing interest in it. There's an enormous momentum in the technology, which may or may not produce any real weapons, but produces fascination and interest and arguments by people who want to see these things done. And our Secretary of Defense said not long ago that he finds the Chemical Weapons Convention to be a straitjacket, to use that word, because of the prohibitions it places on the use of so-called non-lethal chemical weapons. So I leave you with the thought, this is something that requires civil society to talk about and to communicate to government that this would be very dangerous. I'll end with a sentence, namely, to say that whatever is the value, and there may be some, of disabling chemical weapons in military or paramilitary activities, it's got to be incomparably less than the value of maintaining a clear firebreak between peaceful use of biotechnology and the hostile use of biotechnology. Thank you.
Crouch, I must apologise on behalf of my institution for the music, I believe it's called. But we have about 10, 15 minutes left for questions. Can I please ask you to keep your questions short? Yes, you.
Given that the protocol of the BWC has been basically put to bed for the indefinite future, I'm wondering what you see as the future for international efforts to prevent the proliferation of biological weapons, and in particular, if you see the possibility of having an international treaty related to national legislation to implement the BWC.
Is that? Yeah.
I think the world has changed a bit, and it may be quite a while before we get an international agreement, a verification agreement for the Biological Weapons Convention. But I think there is a real opportunity for civil society. Something new. The Sunshine Project was mentioned. It's also possible that individual scientists and other experts could identify cases where field investigations need to be done. We've done that. We've investigated the use of herbicides in Vietnam. We've investigated the use of, or actually the non-use, because it turned out to be false, of the so-called yellow rain in Southeast Asia. And we also investigated, that is small teams with which I had the good fortune to be associated, the epidemic of anthrax in the Soviet Union that occurred in 1979. And produced decisive evidence that it really was from a military facility, that an aerosol escaped and killed people. There's no reason why, in a world which is so electronically connected and where you can fly to most places, that scientists couldn't organize themselves internationally, and other people too, to conduct credible investigations of concerns. And don't wait for government. Just do it.
Another question.
Yes, the
back there. Question to Sue Mayer. I was slightly puzzled by what you said. It's bizarre and not useful to try to recreate the 1918-1919 pandemic flu virus when it's a very clear, basic scientific question why that virus was so virulent. And clearly, there are lessons in the future in terms of emergence of new strains of flu, which can pose equally or worse.
Well, I think.
I think,
given the virulence of the virus and the way the difficulties that there may be in containing it, and the idea that you would want to make an equally virulent copy of that, I think it does beg some really important questions about the knowledge that you would get from that and its justification for it. And I know you can make some arguments that understanding it is a useful process, but it may not. It may be all equally so that you would produce something which proved to be much more damaging than you could usefully use. So, and it also begs lots of questions, which in fact it's very difficult to have engaged in a debate about whether that is a proper and valid use of public funds.
Do you want to come back on that?
No, I mean, I think it's, yeah.
Okay. This is open to whoever would like to respond, but I'm curious to know to what extent do you think current and ongoing developments in both genetics and infectious disease research favors the offense of those defenses?
Who would like to?
That's right. I don't think it matters. There are already plenty of pathogens if anyone wanted to do it. There's hundreds of thousands of people, mostly men, who know how to use explosives all over the world. Very, very few people, maybe none anymore, who really know how to make a biological weapon. But it's not for lack of pathogens. It's just that it's something that most people don't do. So I don't think that it matters a great deal whether new pathogens are invented. One way you could look at this question is to make a list of the properties you want. You want stability, pathogenicity. You'd like some predictability. That's the hardest thing of all, of course. And that's not by engineering a new bug. That's by testing it on people, which you can't do with most things. And then ask, well,
don't we have something? I mean, anthrax is pretty good. Plague is pretty good. Tularemia is pretty good. Those have all been worked on a great deal. What would be so different if you could make something that was 10 times, let's say that you'd need a 1,000 spores of anthrax to infect 50% of a population. If you could drop it down to 100, what's the difference? It's still such a small amount. So I think it's been hyped that there are really such big threats. Now, except in the area possibly of contagion, but even there, you know, we had this problem with the SARS epidemic, and it might come back again some this winter, but there's no vaccine and no antibiotic. We stopped it. How? By isolation. Good old method of isolation. So I'm not saying that there isn't some possibility of coming up with something that's really nasty, but when we have a baseline that's already very nasty, it in a way confuses the subject to get off onto exotic topics like weirdo pathogens, in my opinion.
It's difficult to be against the idea of civil society getting interested in CE and BW. But for those who are advocating that it's a major panacea, I would be interested to know how you think the problems of secrecy can be overcome, secrecy of state projects, the Russian, maybe other programs, secrecy of terrorist laboratories, and the whole embedding of the biotechnology industry in commercial secrecy for reasons of competitiveness. Now, given that structural feature, of particularly of BW, how do you think that civil society actually gets a grip on this? How does it even learn what it should be being termed?
That sounds like
next.
I've never tried to say that civil society's involvement is a panacea and would cure all ills, all evils, perhaps not even very many. I mean, one thing, when you're talking about state programs at least, we have the Chemical Weapons Convention, it's a fine example of a treaty which has a pretty intrusive verification system attached to it. The inspectors go out, it's not as intrusive as what Ron was involved in Iraq. But the inspectors do go out, they do go to military facilities, they do go to civilian facilities. States do have to declare back to the Secretariat in The Hague what capabilities, what facilities they have, what chemicals they work with. It's obviously, it's got its faults, but that kind of a system, you know, that has its advantages. That has a way of opening things up, taking away some layers of secrecy, even if it's not to the outside world as in us as civil society. It's still increases transparency between states and builds confidence between states. And you know, I would argue that the Secretariat and the OPCW, that's the Chemical Weapons Organization in The Hague, itself needs to be more open towards the rest of the world and towards civil society to be demonstrating that it's doing its job and that states are actually, you know, telling the organization what they have, that confidence is being built between states. It doesn't address your point about terrorist labs, but then again, you know, what do we know about terrorist labs, and are they really terrorist labs? I mean, this is one thing that we keep on hearing, but you know, we don't know. Is this just, you know, the hype that we're being given for other reasons?
Okay, one more very quick question and a quick answer, then we have to close up.
There is a lot of anecdotal and some media reports about Israel using chemical weapons against Palestinians. So is there any international verification about this, and what might they be?
The short answer is no. Israel is not a member state of the Chemical Weapons Convention. The Chemical Weapons Convention has 155 states at the moment. Unfortunately, the Middle East frontline states are the ones that are not members. So neither is Palestine, Israel, or Syria member states. So there's no verification.
All right, well, I have been told, unfortunately, that we do have to end on the dot of 8, otherwise we're going to be assaulted by this sound system and a very old-fashioned form of weaponry. So I'd just like to take this opportunity to thank all our speakers for tremendous interest in